Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Gazingram Dialogue. My guest today is Bradley Campbell. Bradley is professor of sociology at California State University in Los Angeles. In this episode, we discuss the shifting dynamics of moral conflict and the conception of victimhood on university campuses and how they're affecting our moral culture and the nature of the science of sociology. So please welcome Bradley to the Gazingram Dialogue. Bradley, thanks for doing this. I've been looking forward to speaking with you this past few weeks.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good talking to you.
You and your co-author, Jason, are very rare in the academic realm. And I think Jonathan Haidt had this, I think he called you guys the prophets of the academic world. How do you feel about that title?
It was a nice thing for Haidt to say, and very good coming from him. Jonathan Haidt has done excellent work on the psychology of morality and social psychology of moral life. And Jason and I were both interested in Haidt's work before we had ever talked with him and about any of this stuff. Haidt wrote a wonderful book a few years ago. Righteous Minds, which is, and the subtitle is Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, and just an excellent kind of account of where moral values come from and what accounts for differences in political and moral beliefs and a lot of controversies now. And I was always interested in Haidt's work. And then Jason and I started talking about these issues of microaggressions, safe spaces, and these kinds of things, and had written an article about it. And then Haidt and Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff wrote this article in The Atlantic called The Coddling of the American Mind, which later became a book. And we sent him the article, and then, and Haidt publicized it and brought us a lot of attention and was nice enough to say these things about us. But it's because we had been writing about these things before they had, and had actually, and before others had, probably, I don't know of anyone else who had tried a kind of social science account of some of these things, accounting for them. Certainly Haidt and Lukianoff have now, and they have their own kind of view of some of the trends behind it, behind some of the campus eruptions and safe space and microaggression movement and these kinds of things. And they have their kind of own way of analyzing it. But we had actually started writing about it in 2014, and when we said that we expected it to spread and had an analysis of it and an understanding of why, like what we were trying to kind of drawing from what we knew of the sociology of morality to understand why this was happening, and the idea is that it would spread further. And while a lot of people kind of heard these terms and thought, oh, this is just kind of a trendy fashion and this will go out, it ended up like causing these huge events on campus, and and suddenly people who had never heard of a microaggression were talking about it, and it's in the New York Times and mainstream media. Something that had been around in activist circles for a while suddenly went mainstream. And so Haidt was nice enough to call us prophets, but I don't know, we did say that we expected it to continue and to spread, and so we were right. We got that right, and we've tried to understand why. Is it just that we were lucky? But I think it's partly because we saw a puzzle, like there was something we didn't quite understand. It was a curiosity too, like new kinds of moral claims were being made, and then. And I think a lot of it is the strength of the theoretical program we're drawing from. Mm-hmm. So it's Donald Black at the University of Virginia he was a sociologist of law, and then it spread from kind of law to more generally trying to understand how people handle moral conflicts. We're drawing from Donald Black's theories about what kinds of, when do people have moral conflicts? What kinds of moral claims do they make? And so when, using that framework of analysis, we're able to, I think, like understand a little of what was going on, and also to kind of like at least predict the near future that it would continue to spread. And you know, we don't know, you know, what the long term future will be, but we honestly profits or not, we didn't expect it to go kind of as far and as fast as it did. We were kind of surprised, like in 2015, some of the stuff happening, like at Yale University, and then later on at Evergreen, where there was kind of this huge breakdown, and some of those campus events surprised even us. We didn't, you know, necessarily expect the extent of it in some places, but we had kind of predicted it.
So Jesus has this famous saying where he says, prophets are not accepted at their own homes. Do you, at your university, how do you, is there that sense where perhaps your own faculty, colleagues are apprehensive to support your work, or even the administration?
That's kind of the issue, right? Like, the label prophet here is kind of, you know, sort of loose. We're applying it a little loosely, and Haidt is too, and you know, a little loosely and humorously, right? So just to make sure that we're clear that that's a lighthearted thing, kind of comparison. It's just about getting a certain social trend right, like, but I think the idea is, if you have anything interesting to say, right, like why is it that Jesus says that, and you know, why is that a general, you know, Jesus puts it as a general principle, right, and not just his own case, and part of it may simply be that if you have anything kind of new or interesting to say, it's obviously going to it's not going to be necessarily accepted, or other people already would have been saying it, right? Like, so it's like the idea. So a lot of conventional ideas are correct. Like, it's not that people are always generally wrong, but where they go wrong, if people come along to correct them, people aren't necessarily receptive to that. And so why would we have something to say when other people didn't about mm-hmm. this sort of thing? And so, you know, it would be because we're looking at things differently, right? Right. So if we're looking at things differently and we have something to say and we turn out to be right, that doesn't necessarily it doesn't necessarily get us acceptance from the people who are looking at things differently to begin with, right? Because they're not going to see it quite the same way. And I think part of it is. Sociologists tend to be on the left politically, and there's a huge range of that from people who are doing really really good sociological work and are on the left and often driven by their left, like kind of left wing commitments in terms of what subject matter they choose. Do we want to investigate like different kinds of inequality here? And that doesn't mean, you know, their work isn't valid. And then there's, of course, the other range, like there are people who are kind of just, more or less ideologues, kind of mm-hmm. like, you know, using as kind of a political platform, and see sociology as not a science, but kind of as just left-wing ideology itself. But I think regardless of that, that whole range of people who are doing very kind of solid scientific work and people who are doing, you know, things that are just overtly ideological, or even like what we might think of as borderline delusional sometimes, but they all kind of share similar commitments politically and are driven by that. And there's a really good book, it's a short thing with a kind of an interesting thesis by the sociologist Christian Smith. And it's called The Sacred Project of American Sociology. And the idea is that you know, this whole body of sociologists are driven by this kind of political program. So sociologists see it, you know, and it's sacred to them, sacred in the sense that the sociologist Emil Durkheim talked about, of just like setting things apart. You know, it doesn't mean necessarily attaching like a religious content to it, but that for them, this is what is set apart and what is untouchable. And And that's kind of just the, you know, just the idea of advancing inequality and progressive change and these kinds of things. So sociologists, no matter, you know, what kind of work they're doing in the field, and he says even the field is extremely fragmented in certain ways, but it's kind of unified by this idea that, well, we still all share this commitment, even if we disagree about methods or about what sociology is. And like, you know, so the sociologists who don't see themselves as kind of radicals politically will at least see like the radicals as kind of, well, they mean well, right? They're on the same team, and we're all kind of pulling together to do this. So if sociologists see themselves as kind of on the side of right, which for them means like, progressive politics, then Jason Manning and I, in writing this book, I mean, we don't see ourselves as being inspired by any kind of political agenda, you know, and we don't think that sociology should be, it's understandable that a lot of people's political commitments drive them to do certain kinds of work, but that can also mean that you overlook certain things that are happening, you know, in certain questions. And in terms of the origin of the ideas, like, you know, Jason and I tend to not be as left-wing as most sociologists, right? And so, like, there's a kind of, like, you know, willingness to ask questions maybe and frame things that other people wouldn't. So when we see people, you know, activists, you know, campus activists making certain kinds of new moral claims, we weren't actually, like, you know, we weren't driven by some kind of outrage about it. Like these events that happened on campus later, we have serious problems with some of it in terms of the threats to freedom of speech, academic freedom, or just kind of how the effect we think it might have on human relations and stuff. But the first thing is we were just curious about what was happening. It was more like that certain kinds of claims were being made that would not be in other environments. And so just, you know, as people who'd been studying morality from a sociological standpoint, that just kind of posed a question for us. If we were more driven by kind of left-wing commitments, then we might be less inclined to start asking these questions, because we would just be thinking like, oh, the campus activists, they're pushing for equality. How can we help them? Or what is this great, you know, movement that's happening? And instead we're kind of like, what's going on here? You know, why are people, you know, why is microaggression suddenly a concept? And it wasn't even initially like that we had any kind of, you know, big moral condemnation of it. It just like we were noticing that these were kinds of moral claims that would not be made in other environments. So when people are saying like, oh, there's a microaggression, which is a small slight, but it's supposed to, you know, the idea is it adds up over time. So, you know, an ethnic minority or some other kind of disadvantaged group experiences these things in conversation, other kinds of things where they're slighted in some way. But the idea is that the slight isn't just a slight that can be ignored, because it adds up over time and causes them great harm. Mm-hmm. So that was the logic of it. But, you know, again, if we were just starting out from a standpoint of trying to advance left-wing causes, we might think, well, how can we advance this concept? But instead, we were kind of thinking, why is it that there are certain environments where people are told, you know, ignore slights, right? You don't want, you know, that's kind of the morality of them. Ignore slights, don't respond. And then there are other kinds of environments will say, you know, not only don't ignore slights, but if somebody slights you, you fight them, or, you know, maybe you challenge them to a duel. And then in this environment, they were like not ignoring certain kinds of slights, but the reaction wasn't violence. It was complain about it, right? Appeal to authorities, draw attention to it on social media. And so we're just saying, like, one thing, people have different kinds of moral grievances in different environments, different kinds of moral frameworks of how to understand what's happening to them, or what they should ignore and what they should act on, and different ways of acting on it. And I think, like, so in terms of like whether people react to it or, you know, they're not accepting it, we're trying to understand what's going on. And I think we did a pretty good job of that. And in the sense that something we said was a new kind of moral claim suddenly, you know, came to be everywhere and began changing things. I've always wondered, like, why is it that like the activists who support these are so resistant to that notion, right? Like that it's sort of like you would think there's a viewpoint they could take, which would be like, oh, you know, these are wonderful new moral claims we're making and this new way of thinking about morality, and these sociologists have identified it and identified some of the causes, right? Even if they are critical, and they shouldn't be, of it, right? If they're critical in other contexts of it, not in the work. But instead, there's sort of the reaction of like, either, you know, that's not what happened, it's happening, or we've labeled it wrong, or something like that, which may be, but you can see like, it does seem that there's a, like a, you know, so if, you know, the prophet not being accepted in their hometown kind of thing, like, are we, you know, does it get a, you know, a super good reaction in sociology, and especially from the people who are sort of more sympathetic to left-wing causes? Not generally. And I think it's, you know, for a similar reason, even if we're not really prophets, but it's for the similar reason that, like, we're noticing something different. That's how we are able to predict something other people weren't. Mm-hmm. And that means that our thinking on it is slightly unconventional, and then therefore isn't even really accepted when we're right. It's just kind of the framing and those kinds of things that we've accepted.
Yeah, this is where you have the three cultures that you guys talk about, the victimhood culture, the honor culture, and the dignity culture, right?
Right.
And I was thinking about this, and I thought the victimhood culture seems very similar to a reverse version of the Indian caste system, where the Indian caste system, the Brahmins are the ones that are so high up, the most privileged, you know, they have all the privilege, and then the untouchables are the ones below. And within the Indian system, you don't want to be an untouchable. Whereas here, the untouchables are the ones who are the most victimized, and we're trying to, there's the oppression Olympics, who can accrue the most victim points. And it's the total opposite, where the Brahmins or the holy ones or the most privileged are on the bottom.
Yeah. And it's the flipping of things, but I think part of the reaction to it is people not understanding or simply not believing, rejecting the idea, you know, advantage and disadvantage, or you know, status and other kinds of things, is very situational, right, to particular environments. So the fact that, like, so, you know, so it's not that if we're looking at people, you know, if we're talking about that there's a certain kind of ideology that we've called victimhood culture, where people get a kind of status from from successful claims of victimhood, right? Particularly being seen as victims of societal wide oppression in some way, right? So that, like, divide into like their identities, which are like oppressor identities, and then identities which are victims, right? Victim identities. And, you know, then the idea is to give more, say, more weight to the words and the testimony of the victims, to give them support in their struggles and those kinds of things. And by doing that, and of course you're trying to, you know, you're trying to aid the victims of oppression. But even if you're right, assuming to the extent to which you're right that there's that oppression there in an overall societal, you know, a society-wide there's still going to be there's situations in which any situation in which the activists who are fighting this oppression in this way have power and have dominance is going to be a situation where they, like as you're saying, like reverse it, right? Like it comes out of a desire to help the victims of oppression, but aiding people and giving more weight to their words and all that's creating a new kind of social status, and it's a status based on victimhood. And as you're saying, like, you know, in traditional cultures, and many of them, you know, it's opposite. The Indian caste system is, you know, the caste systems are status systems that are especially rigid, and that, you know, so it's just like a heightened version of it, where, you know, complete social boundaries between people, you know, they can't eat together, and so like in, you know, the traditional Indian caste system, or the situation of blacks and whites in the pre-civil rights American South, that's another kind of caste system, where there is this kind of, there would be this system of oppression, which pretty much kind of pervades every aspect of life, right? And then it's an interesting kind of paradox, because it's people who are coming, who are trying to work against systems like that, right? Like, and the idea would be, even if we don't have the same caste system, there's still these holdovers from the past, and structural disadvantage and oppression built in. And that's not wrong. But there's certain ways of kind of framing what's going on and of opposing that kind of, will flip things in certain environments, where then it's the historical victims of oppression that you're giving a kind of status over the historical oppressors, or like the people you now consider to be oppressors, but they may not have power, in every particular environment, in activist circles and other kinds of places. And this is, we never claimed that victimhood culture was something that had or already had like completely overtaken, American society, so that American society was now, completely in a victimhood culture. We're talking about the circles. We're talking about something that's a matter of degree, for one thing, a victimhood becoming a kind of status. And you see it like on college campuses and places like that, in the circles where activists are influential, there it's in its heightened form, and then maybe to a larger degree elsewhere, but certainly not not in every place or every like social location in the United States. But it's, it's not that difficult to understand why it would happen. It's that the efforts to help the oppression, the victims of oppression, and the efforts to fight oppression and get rid of it involve giving a kind of status to those you see as the victims. And that's, what we called it victimhood culture, because victimhood becomes a kind of status, and which is certainly not in traditional societies where people want to be seen as strong and capable and wealthy and advantaged and things like that. And then if it confers a benefit in some environment, some social environments, to be labeled as a victim of oppression, then it's like also likely that people will then try to portray themselves as that more, right? And try to successfully make claims of, that they've been oppressed in some way, and that the concept gets expanded, right? What counts as oppression, and it's also an environment where we might see false claims of victimhood, like with, certain hate crime hoaxes, like the Jussie Smollett case, and those kinds of things. So it's like lots of things going on. And it's not deriving from the bad, and some of those are things that are undesirable, we might see as undesirable in some ways, like if the concept of oppression becomes too expanded or false claims are made and those kinds of things. But it's not out of it's out of a sincere there's a sincerity on the part of the people who are doing it that society is this oppressive place and this is the way to fight it. And, it doesn't even mean that they're wrong, that it has these effects. They may still be wrong in certain ways, but it's the result the natural result of trying to create these environments where you're fighting oppression and putting that as the supreme, sort of the main moral value, right? Like what becomes like of supreme moral importance to people in like activist circles on campus? Is it, there are of course other virtues people might look at, honesty or, this or that, but does it become fighting oppression? And it seems to us that like that in certain environments becomes like the, kind of, the main thing that morality is about, right, for people.
Is it true that the majority of radical activists come out of students under majors that are classified as X studies, so like gender studies or women's studies or any form of studies. Is it true that in those academic fields, there is, I guess, a very strong emphasis on victimhood culture or victimhood mentality?
I don't know, in terms of the numbers of like, you know, where the student activists are coming from, mm-hmm. but in terms of what the fields themselves are like and what mm-hmm. they teach, they're, those disciplines for the most part, in practice are where the kind of ideology of what we call victimhood, or you might, they would call it critical studies or something like
critical
that. You
know,
critical theory, critical studies. You know, sometimes it's like divided into different things. So there's like critical race theory, or there's radical feminism, or there's other words that they use are like intersectionality. You know, where people are interested in how the intersection of multiple oppressed identities works, and that comes out of those different kinds of, ethnic area studies or gender studies, predominantly. It comes out of, and sociology to a lesser extent. So, so sociology is a more fragmented field. This is one of the things that was a little puzzling, that's been a little puzzling to us, is that you have there's a range of sociological theory, right? And there are kind of different, they've been different perspectives. So people who are kind of rational choice theorists, which is the same, it's theoretical approach you'd use in economics, where you, explain behavior as the least costly means to a goal, right? People are goal seeking, and they're, choosing behavior that gets them to that goal. And that's how economists understand economic life. And that's one way of you can apply that to behavior, and there are sociologists who do that. And then there are, there have been sociologists who use, these various other frameworks of understanding behavior. That's kind of one. And then there is like that kind of critical theory thing, which can be called conflict theory, or it really comes out of Marxism originally. Mm-hmm. So Marx's view of class was similar to now, although, in Marxist theory, it's completely class based, and the change has been to say, well, there's class, but then there's also race, gender, sexuality, all these other identities, and they're, one isn't privileged over the other. Like with Marx, any kind of oppression is, class based. But it's like to look at the world in terms of oppressed and oppressors, which is, the framework that Marx had used. But there's a body of work in that theory, in that, using that theoretical approach. Now, my view and Jason Manning's view had always been that kind of theory hadn't been very successful in explaining human behavior. And other theoretical approaches, were better, some of them not. Regardless of our view, it's not the dominant theory in sociology, right? Like, it's popular among a lot of sociologists, but it's never been dominant. And so then there's something a little weird about being in sociology, which is already very left wing, right? And then seeing like ideas go mainstream that are being drawn from kind of the most, not only the most left wing, the sociologist kind of committed to politically, but also from a framework that isn't generally accepted even by sociologists, right? Mm. But it was dominant in those other fields. So like whether it's critical legal studies or critical race theory, there's like in portions of law schools and the different studies departments, this was the dominant approach of analyzing things in terms of oppression. And again, it's one way you can analyze things. It's just not the only way. And it hadn't been the dominant way in sociology. And so it's more fringe, in terms of academic life for years, like kind of more on the fringes. And then, and it gives rise to these kinds of ideas and these new moral claims. And so it makes sense from this standpoint that if human interaction is understood in terms of oppression. So it's not, from this standpoint, the question isn't like, it isn't to examine the degree to which people are being oppressed, like as it's a variable that could be more or less in certain environments. So that's how I would look at it. And I would also want to look at things situationally, like somebody who has power in one situation doesn't in another. But in this framework, the idea is to assume kind of a society-wide objective oppression, like what, you know, men oppressing women, or the bourgeoisie oppressing the proletariat, or heterosexuals oppressing homosexuals, or whites oppressing blacks, or people of color, and that's kind of the frame. That's the standpoint which you start. It's not the thing to be investigated as a variable. You understand oppression as the framework, and then you interpret interactions in that sense. So then it makes sense that if people are in a conversation, say, like if it's a minority, a racial minority in a conversation with a white person, that conversation is in some way oppressive, whether it's like because there are microaggressions or something like that, because that's the framework for understanding behavior. But to take that kind of perspective, which is, it's again, it's one perspective, it's drawn from these theoretical frameworks, and to make it forming the dominant perspective of certain academic departments, like these new departments, the studies programs, when there are lots of different ways you can analyze race, right, or lots of different ways you can analyze gender relations, and so even those studies programs should be drawing from the range of sociological perspectives instead of just one that's never been dominated in sociology. And then to have it become into the mainstream media or to be institutionalized at campuses so that you get like microaggression training, which is based on a which comes out of a theoretical approach that not only doesn't have like a strong scientific basis, like in terms of the claims that's being made, but it was only but it was one perspective of many you could draw from to understand the behavior. So like even if you look at it as, I mean, we could take issue with some of the claims, right? But even if you say, well, like this is a perspective coming from serious academics, it's still only one perspective. And to the fact that it suddenly became dominant and became, you know, institutionalized in the rest of the, you know, university was a little bit, it's a little bit surprising. And we predicted that it would spread, but the quickness of it, it was kind of unusual, given that, like I said, even still, you know, this isn't like, I mean, sociologists wouldn't necessarily take on these ideas, but I'm just saying like it's not the framework of the oppression and victimhood isn't the dominant framework. Now in these other studies fields it is, and that's its own can be its own problem, you know. But they did this. I don't know if you've heard of this. Some people have called it like the Sokol squared hoax and different kinds of things. But James Lindsay and Peter Bagassian and Helen Pluckrose, they did this thing where they sent out, you know, these terrible articles, like fake articles, but were like all about kind of oppression and victimhood, and sent them to some of these journals. And kind of the interesting thing was I like all of them. They have interesting things to say, and the project showed some, you know, things like they got like acceptances at some of these journals, and some of them, when they gave them reviews, it was more like that they didn't take the oppression thing far enough, right? Like, and they were saying things like, you know, they had, I don't remember some of all the examples, but they had, an article about, behavior between dogs at the dog park and trying That's to right. analyze that in terms of oppression. They, in another article, they took portions of Hitler's Mein Kampf and just rewrote it for like men and women instead of a race thing, you know, like, so it's like the feminist version of it, and yeah. sort of, and got it accepted. But kind of the interesting thing, is then they at first presented it like, oh, this indicts all these fields. But if you look closely at, like, none of the sociology journals accepted this stuff, right? They just, like, they rejected it. And so it's not that sociology doesn't have a problem, but it doesn't have that big of a problem. And it kind of also points to the idea that there is, you know, this stuff is contentious. Like people don't, the sociology journals that they sent to were, you know, they're better journals and asking for higher quality work. But that's part of the issue is that, you know, in some of the fields, the journals that are supposed to be the best journals were able to be fooled in this way, right? Because people who, in other words, they couldn't distinguish between somebody parodying their ideology and somebody seriously writing it, right? So there wasn't that enough of a difference between what was obviously meant to be crazy and what other people, you know, and so, but there was in sociology. So, you know, there's still, and that may change, you know, maybe that it overtakes sociology eventually too. But, the fact that sociologists might be more sympathetic to this stuff doesn't mean that they've, you know, they've yet abandoned all standards. And that's something that's kind of important also to understand, you know, in terms of, you know, that this stuff doesn't, for people who are less sympathetic to like us or and more sympathetic to academia and maybe to left-wing causes, they should realize like that there are still, even with, you know, in regular social science perspectives, different ways of looking at these things, you know, and that we don't want to just rush into making policy based on things that aren't supported that well.
Can you do social? I think I'm wondering if you could do sociology. Can you do sociology objectively without any sort of value behind claims or observations that are made?
Well, the short answer is yes, but it kind of needs some elaboration. So. I've always supported what is the sociologist Max Weber called value-free sociology, and a lot of sociologists would reject that out of hand. They can't have value-free sociology, I agree with Weber, but I think partly because he called it value-free sociology, which maybe isn't the best term for it, and you know, and some of his lack of clarity on it too. Has led it to kind of attacks. My academic mentor, Donald Black, wrote, an article in, I think, 2013 in the British Journal of Sociology, and it's called, on the almost inconceivable misunderstandings concerning value-free sociology, which was a term that came from Weber. Like, Weber talked about people's almost inconceivable misunderstandings. So on the almost inconceivable misunderstandings concerning value-free sociology. So the idea was that when sociologists start talking about this issue, some of their misunderstandings of the claims of those of us who are saying you can have value-free sociology are almost inconceivable in the sense that, and that may be like, you know, snarky, but, you know, they'll say things like, well, people are always influenced by their values. Well, yeah, of course people are influenced by their values. We never claim, so objectivity is probably not the best word because it makes it sound like there actually is a view from nowhere, right? Like, you know, from no social standpoint that's pure, you know, and completely objective. But the idea that people are influenced by their values, either like in choosing subjects of study, like, you know, is true and obvious and correct. So like, if people have a range of things to look at, like a lot of people will be influenced by various ways, just in terms of, you know, I spend a lot of time studying genocide. Part of the problem, you know, part of the reason for that is I'm morally concerned about it, right? Like I find it morally horrific, and that's part of what leads me to want to study it, right? But, and it may be even when you interpret things, if you have things you'd like to find for some reason, either because you want to show that things are bad so that you can get people mobilized, or you want to show things that are, you know, are good so that you provide hope or whatever it is, you know, you can be influenced by your desire to see something and, you know, interpreting something a certain way, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea isn't that either in our choice of subject matter or in our analyses that we're actually completely objective. The idea would be, first of all, factual statements and value statements are different things. So somebody who's making a claim about what should be, you know, whether there should be more equality, of wealth or whatever the case may be, they're not doing sociology when they make that claim. There's nothing wrong with making value judgments either, but value judgments are not science, right? It's not an observation about the social world, which is what sociology should be, observing and explaining the social world. So the idea isn't that people are never influenced by their values in various ways. The idea is that you can make statements that are value-free, value-neutral statements, or you can make value judgments, and they're different kinds of statements. And you can't, statements that are simply factual statements will not lead you to a value claim, right? So this was what was called, Hume's law. It goes by various names, but it's the idea that you can't derive a value judgment from facts alone. So philosophers then might investigate, they might have all kinds of views about where then do values come from, right? And so there are people who think values are just subjective, and then people who think they are objective in some way. But if they are objective, they are not observations about the world. They're claims about what the world should be, right? So you either appeal to something, again, there's a range of philosophical positions on that, whether that then involves something supernatural or metaphysical or something. Mm. But it's not simply, but it's either like an expression of preferences, or it's a description about something beyond the observable world, mm. right? It's not a value claim, is not just a claim about what can be observed. So not only can sociology be value free in that sense that it doesn't make claims of value, it can't be otherwise, right? So, because if you're making value judgments, that's not doing sociology. Just like, a physicist isn't going to, telling you like how atoms should be arranged, right? You're describing how they are. So sociology not only, can be value free, but value claims are not sociology, period. So it can't be otherwise. That doesn't mean, so in practice, people may mix it. Our view would be that people are then they're actually being deceptive about what's happening. They're confused themselves, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to use sociology to say what the world should be like, then you're doing something confusing or deceptive there, because sociology can't directly tell you that. It can inform your claims, but you need to be clear. If you're going to make value claims, be clear about what those claims are, and then how you're using, then you can use sociological theory or research to try to understand what the best policies to achieve what you'd like to see in the world are, that's something that's legitimate and important, but that's a different matter from sociology being able to give you a political program or a system of morality. That has to come from somewhere else.
So then the sociologists that are pushing ideology or some sort of political agenda, they're not doing sociology.
That would be our claim, right? I mean, and of course there are sociologists who in the discipline who disagree with this, this is contentious, but Jason and I both, and Donald Black, our advisor. And many others. I was always influenced by Peter Berger too, who's deceased now, but was a well-known sociologist who had certainly a different approach from ours. He was more phenomenological in his sociology. He wrote a book called The Social Construction of Reality. Always a big advocate for value-free sociology, coming from Max Weber had talked about, and so I think it's not only important. I agree, that the more there may be actual sociological theory mixed in with ideological claims, but it's sometimes it's almost inseparable. It's almost inseparable, with Marx, we can kind of, if we break down Marx and discard some of it and try to reinterpret what's wrong, we can know, we get some really good ideas about how class systems work and how one, and especially about historical change, how, like, you know, the breakdown of feudalism and how it emerged capitalism. So there's lots of good, you know, social science in Marx, but it's hard if you just take it straightforwardly. It's inseparable from his moral claims, right? And particularly, you know, Marx has claimed that there's objective exploitation in the relationship between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, between an owner and a worker, right? That but to say that somebody is being exploited or something in that sense, it's actually a moral claim about the work, right? It's not, and so, you know, Marx was wrong in thinking that you could have like an objective measure of, you know, that you'd be able to point to, that you'd prove exploitation or something else that has some kind of moral content, like, you know, because he means it that way, right? That exploitation is bad. And that's partly where he goes off and why the predictions end up wrong. And people who are using this oppression victimhood framework, you can do it in a way that is, you know, is value neutral. I think, you know, you can certainly, because you can certainly talk about power, and sociologists do that and try to understand power differences and draw from these approaches. But in practice, like with the things we talk about, the critical studies and those kinds of things, it almost never is. It's a political ideology. They don't actually claim otherwise. I mean, they don't use the term political ideology, but they don't say that they are a value neutral science. You know, they like to appeal to, to Marx's statement that, philosophers have interpreted the world, or I think that's how it goes, but the second part is, the point is to change it, right? So they're like, they're about changing the world and how that's to be done. That's not sociology. That's not social science, even if there's some social science mixed in with it. That's a problem. And again, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't then study power and oppression. Even oppression might be a value-loaded term, but power in situations. But I think if you do it that way, part of what you're going is social science. I mean, and science generally is about trying to understand variation. So you look for things, you know, you try to see what can be variable and how it can be explained. But the fact that, like, what they see as oppression, a certain kind of power, you know, isn't actually variable, right? Like that it's just, you know, identities never switch different ways, or there's never like more or less oppression here. It's just like, start with the idea that people are oppressed and then interpret, interactions and other things based on that. And I think, like, you could maybe come up with a lot of good social science propositions, you know, from that framework. In practice, there's almost nothing. I mean, I don't know a very much, like, in terms of if we're looking for, like, testable propositions about the social world, not much comes up, not much, you know, you don't get much of that from critical theory or conflict theory or whatever it might be called.
What role do you think the rise of administrative states and the rise of administrative staff in the universities play in victimhood culture? Because there seems to be a definite increase in victimhood culture around North America and I guess Europe too. Is there any, do they play any sort of role, administrative staff?
Yeah, early on, like our first article about this in 2014 called Microaggression and Moral Cultures, talked about this, and we elaborated a lot on it in the Rise of Victimhood Culture, our book. But this is kind of one of the key things. So in trying to understand, like, the different cultures, so if honor culture is an environment where, honor, which is kind of at its root, having a reputation for bravery and a willingness to engage in violence, that becomes a kind of status. And it exists in societies where law is less effective or maybe there's no law at all. And so a lot of, like, tribal societies, would have some kind of honor. The honor might reside with the clans or something. Or you have like European aristocrats in the 1500s who, like, because the legal, they reject the law from their own affairs and handle disputes themselves. So if you have a situation where there's not law or where there aren't legal authorities who are superior enough to you to act as, to intervene in your disputes effectively, it makes sense. Like people develop this tendency to like want to demonstrate they can handle their conflicts themselves. Like if you attack us, we'll attack back, right? And you need to develop that reputation to keep yourself from being attacked. And then that spills over into the rest of life, right? Like you insult me, I'm going to demonstrate I'll fight you. The whole thing is to, the best thing you can be is brave, right? And the worst thing you can be is a coward in that environment, right? So that, it's not that in, you know, it's not that even in present day society, people like to be cowards. It's that it's the emphasis put on that particular virtue, right? Right. Of bravery, right? Bravery is, you know, normally thought of as good, but how important is that one virtue compared to others? In honor societies, it's huge. So part of why other societies are not honor societies is the effectiveness of law, right? So, so establishing stable law and legal authorities in government. So we moved in the United States and the West from honor cultures to what people have called dignity cultures, where you then, if there's no shame in going to law to handle your disputes. If somebody, you know, murders your family member, you don't go retaliate for that. You have the legal authorities deal with it. And that's, you know, and the idea is that creates more peace overall and stuff, but it didn't just come about because people just up and decided this would be a good idea. It took centuries, and it took like the state like claiming a monopoly on violence and establishing that they could intervene, and it changes then the moral culture. So people no longer think that it's shameful to go to the police. They think it's good, and they think it's shameful actually to go kill somebody in response. Or if you're insulted, you don't respond with violence, you ignore it, right? Or right. if you're injured, maybe you sue somebody, right? So you can go to the state for more serious stuff. For other stuff, you ignore it. And so that's a different kind of culture. So then when we get to victimhood culture, we see people appealing to authorities like campus officials and other kinds of, but over small offenses. So it's the same concern with small offenses and slights that you might see in honor cultures, like where men challenge other men to duels over insults, but they're not handling it themselves. They're not challenging somebody to a duel or attacking them. They're like they're complaining or they're appealing to authorities and stuff like that. So part of so just like dignity culture arose because of the presence of law, that's also kind of a necessary condition for there to be like law or some kind of authority, stable authority. For victimhood culture, right? Because people are appealing to authorities, or at least third parties who would be appealed, can be appealed to in conflict. So, we see people not like developing the idea of handling these things themselves, but going on social media and complaining to people who might be interested, complaining to university officials, putting new policies in place. So at universities, like why has this, been able to take root there? And part of it, was we had other ideas too, like about, part of it was that increasing diversity and equality meant that people were then more concerned with minor offenses against diversity and equality. If you're in an environment where people are more unequal and less diverse, then people might be concerned about more serious offenses, but let minor things go. But as things like improve from that standpoint, from the standpoint of if you're thinking more diversity and more equality is a better thing, it's actually the things improving that you turn attention to minor issues, right? And that's another thing I think like people often resist, because you're saying like, oh, you're focused on minor issues because things have gotten better, but the activists don't want to acknowledge that things have gotten better, right? But then the other thing is stable authority. So it's not enough just that people are concerned with offenses against diversity and equality, slights and these kinds of things, but that they feel like there's a need to take action, to have authorities take action. And so when you look at this, not only are there, administrators and things like that on campus, but they've increased, like in the last 20 years. the ratio of administration to faculty has greatly increased. And this is something we talked about, and a lot of that, and a lot of the administrators are specifically involved in kind of like diversity initiatives. There's like, you know, diversity offices and chief diversity officers and vice presidents of diversity. You know, you go on through, you all have these big staffs and things like that. And it makes sense. I mean, there's just the basic idea that people with jobs, you know, to do things, you know, if a bunch of people are assigned to deal with a certain kind of moral problem, they have to go and find things to do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and deal with. But also just this principle that, like, the presence of authority leads people to appeal to authorities in their conflict, right? To become dependent on them more and to have less, independence in handling conflict. So we see that as very important. If you see victimhood culture as a problem, which Haidt and Lukiana talked about the fact that you may be harming, you know, the disadvantaged people you're trying to help in various ways, by encouraging them to take offenses, to take offense at things. And, you know, if you're causing harm where you intend to cause help, or if it causes, or if it restricts freedom of speech or academic freedom or the other kind of things that people talk about, you know, how can you, you know, what can you do about it? And it's hard, you know, because we don't want to decrease diversity or equality. But one thing you might do about it is try to decrease that third thing, you know, the third thing, which is the growth of administration. So maybe cut back some of the administrators, not to keep expanding the offices of diversity and those kinds of things. That's easier said than done too, right? But that may be one of the best ways to begin reducing some of it. Just like, get rid of some of the authority, or at least stop expanding it.
All right. I know you have to get going. So before, where can the listeners find you online? Do you have Twitter?
I have a Twitter account, and it's Campbell Socprof. So it's like, Campbell, CAMPBELLSOCPROF. Like, it's like, it's supposed to be like sociology professor, Socprof. Yeah. Right? But, and I like, sometimes I didn't realize, but then people were like, what is it, Socprof? And I'm like, no, it's Socprof, like sociology, but it's Campbell Socprof. Jason Manning and I have a website called the Victimhood Report victimhoodculture.com. We haven't been updating it as recently, but sometimes we have different things like we'd like to comment on in terms of what's happening in the culture, because there's always so much. For a while go back to updating that, but we have a lot of like little blog posts there. victimofculture.com as the Victimhood Report, and checked out our book, The Rise of Victimhood Culture, and I think we're always like available. Sometimes we get emails from people, try to answer them when we can or something, but they're easy to find and look up.
Okay, no, that's good. Thank you so much for this conversation. It has been fascinating for me. So I hope you have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.